11. So it was. The Stresemann era, the only genuine period of peace that my generation in Germany has experienced, had begun, a period of 6 years, from 1924 to 1929, during which Stresemann directed German policy from the Foreign Office. Perhaps one can say the same of policy as of women, the best are the least talked about. If that is right, then Stresemann's policy was outstanding. Politics were hardly discussed during his time. There was still some argument in the first 2 or 3 years, clearing up the ravages of inflation. The Dawes Plan, Locarno, Thuari, and the entry into the League of Nations were events that were still talked about, but no more than that. All of a sudden, politics ceased to be something worth breaking plates for. After 1926, or thereabouts, there was almost nothing worth discussing anymore. The newspapers had to find their headlines in foreign countries. In Germany, all was quiet. All was orderly. Events took a tranquil course. There were occasional changes of government. Sometimes the parties of the right were in power, and sometimes those of the left. It made no great difference. The foreign minister was always Gustav Stresemann. That meant peace, no risk of a crisis, and business as usual. Money came into the country. The currency maintained its value, and business was good. The older generation began to retrieve its store of experience from the attic, burnish it bright and show it off, as if it had never been invalidated. The last 10 years were forgotten like a bad dream. The day of judgment was remote again, and there was no demand for saviours or revolutionaries. The public sector required only competent officials, and the private sector only hard-working businessmen. There was an ample measure of freedom, peace, and order, everywhere the most well-meaning liberal-mindedness, good wages, good food, and a little political boredom. Everyone was cordially invited to concentrate on their personal lives, to arrange their affairs according to their own tastes, and to find their own paths to happiness. Now something strange happened. And with this, I believe I am about to reveal one of the most fundamental political events of our time, something that was not reported in any newspaper. By and large, that invitation was declined. It was not what was wanted. A whole generation was, it seemed, at a loss as to how to cope with the offer of an unfettered private life. A generation of young Germans had become accustomed to having the entire content of their lives delivered gratis, so to speak, by the public sphere, all the raw material for their deeper emotions, for love and hate, joy and sorrow, but also all their sensations and thrills, accompanied though they might be by poverty, hunger, death, chaos and peril. Now that these deliveries suddenly ceased, people were left helpless, impoverished, robbed and disappointed. They had never learned to live from within themselves, how to make an ordinary private life great, beautiful and worthwhile, how to enjoy it and make it interesting. So they regarded the end of the political tension and the return of private liberty not as a gift, but as a deprivation. They were bored. Their minds strayed to silly thoughts, and they began to sulk. In the end they waited eagerly for the first disturbance, the first setback or incident, so that they could put this period of peace behind them and set out on some new collective adventure. To be precise, the occasion demands precision, because in my opinion it provides the key to the contemporary period of history. It was not the entire generation of young Germans. Not every single individual reacted in this fashion. There were some who learned during this period, belatedly and a little clumsily, as it were, how to live. They began to enjoy their own lives, weaned themselves from the cheap intoxication of the sports of war and revolution, and started to develop their own personalities. It was at this time that, invisibly and unnoticed, the Germans divided into those who later became Nazis and those who would remain non-Nazis. I have already remarked in passing that the capacity for individual life and happiness is, in any case, less developed among the Germans than among other peoples. Later, in France and England, I observed with astonishment and envy, but also learned to appreciate, what a wealth of simple joy and what an inexhaustible source of lifelong pleasure the Frenchman finds in eating and drinking, intellectual debate, and the artistic pursuit of love. and the Englishman in the cultivation of gardens, the companionship of animals, and the sports and hobbies he pursues with such childlike gravity. The average German knows nothing of the sort. Only a certain cultured class, not particularly small, but a minority, of course, used to find, and still finds, similar sustenance and pleasure in books and music, in independent thought, and the creation of a personal philosophy. For this class, the ideals and joys of life were the exchange of ideas, a contemplative conversation over a glass of wine, a few faithfully and rather sentimentally maintained and nurtured friendships, and, last but not least, an intense, intimate family life. Almost all of this had fallen into ruin and decay in the decade from 1914 to 1924, and the younger generation had grown up without fixed customs and traditions. Outside this cultured class, the great danger of life in Germany has always been emptiness and boredom, with the exception perhaps of certain geographical border regions, such as Bavaria and the Rhineland, where a whiff of the south, some romance, and a sense of humour entered the picture. The menace of monotony hangs, as it has always hung, over the great plains of northern and eastern Germany, with their colourless towns and their all too industrious, efficient, and conscientious businesses and organisations. With it comes a horror vacui and the yearning for salvation, through alcohol, through superstition, or best of all through a vast, overpowering, cheap mass intoxication. The basic fact that in Germany only a minority, not necessarily from the aristocracy or the moneyed class, understands anything of life and knows how to lead it, a fact that incidentally makes the country inherently unsuitable for democratic government, had been dangerously exacerbated by the events of the years from 1914 to 1924. The older generation had become uncertain and timid in its ideals and convictions, and began to focus on youth, with thoughts of abdication, flattery, and high expectations. Young people themselves were familiar with nothing but political clamour, sensation, anarchy, and the dangerous lure of irresponsible numbers games. They were only waiting to put what they had witnessed into practice themselves, but on a far larger scale. Meanwhile, they viewed private life as boring, bourgeois, and old-fashioned. The masses, too, were accustomed to all the varied sensations of disorder. Moreover, they had become weak and doubtful about their most recent great superstition, the creed, celebrated with pedantic, orthodox fervour, of the magical powers of the omniscient St. Mark's, and the inevitability of the automatic course of history prophesied by him. Thus, under the surface, all was ready for a vast catastrophe. Meanwhile, golden peace, serenity, benevolence, and goodwill reigned in the tangible world of public affairs. Even the heralds of the coming calamity seemed to fit seamlessly into the peaceable scene.